This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
For years, I was so fed up with shampoo, I just stopped washing my hair. I quit completely. I was so sick of poofy, frizzy, limp hair, distorting my natural oils. Until a few months ago, I found Modern Mammals, and it changed everything. And by the way, right now you can visit modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. So check that out. So look, I heard about this through the podcast, and before I agreed to advertise, they sent it to me and I was reluctant. But let me tell you, I should not have been. This stuff is absolutely magical. My hair felt better, smelled way better, and most importantly, looked better. And I know it will do the same for you as well. It doesn't have those hair-ruining chemicals like other products, and it doesn't leave any leftover residues. It works. Don't believe me? Go read their awesome reviews online as well. Go to modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code LSS. Don't forget to use our promo code LSS so they know we sent you. Friends, and welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, as always, Shane Told. So great to have you on episode 27 of the podcast. I can't believe we've already done 27 of these things, but it's rad. I'm having so much fun doing it. Thank you so much for being here. If it's your first time tuning in, this podcast is all about me talking to other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a band. And today we have a great front man and one of my best friends in music, absolutely, Anthony Ranieri of Bayside. Now, I don't want to get too much into the story of how me and Anthony met because we talk about it in the podcast, but I've known him a very, very long time. In fact, he's one of the first other frontmen on tour I ever met. So it's cool. He's not only one of my oldest friends, but also one of my best friends. So it was so great to talk to him. He's been through some shit lately. I've been through some shit lately. So it was really, really nice just to talk to an old friend and chat and just really open up about everything from, you know, his upbringing to songwriting, to their new album, Vacancy, which is coming out very soon. And he talks all about that and really interesting stuff in this podcast. And I know you're going to enjoy it. So stick around. It's a long one, but stick around till the end because the best stuff comes probably around the hour 10 mark. So stay in for the long haul. Okay, guys? And as always, I love hearing from you guys. Please feel free to get in touch. My favorite way is probably hitting us up on Twitter. It's just at Lead Singer Syn, S-Y-N. We've got Instagram, at Lead Singer Syndrome. There's a Facebook page set up. I'm sure you can search and find relatively easily. And of course, if you're old school like me, just send an old-fashioned email, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. And I love to hear suggestions for the show, of guests, any feedback. Somebody complained last week the audio is too quiet. I'm sorry if that was the case. It's funny because I didn't actually use proper mastering software for the first time. So, hey, there you go, right? Someone calls me out on it. So that's what it's for. I really don't want this just to be me talking to you guys. I really love it to be a back and forth, just like we have every week with our guests. So thanks again for tuning in. This is a long one, so I'm going to cut this short. But the only thing I want to say right now is if you love the show, please check out the Amazon affiliate link. All you got to do is go to leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. That takes you right to the Amazon homepage. You log in as normal, put in your details, you'll be signed in, and whatever you buy, we get 4%. And Amazon sells everything. So please, if you ever shop on Amazon or online at all, if you can use that link, it's just leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. It would really help us out. Anyways, let's keep this intro short and let's hit it right now. Here's my dude, Anthony Ranieri of Bayside.
up, bud? How are you?
Dude, good, man. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise. I'm glad that we're finally doing this.
Finally connected. Yeah, I know. I think this is 26 episodes in or something. And I figured when I started this, you'd be like one of the first people.
Yeah, right.
But no, man, this shit's been going well for me, man. Not only has it, been successful, but I fucking have a blast doing it.
That's great.
Yeah, man. Some of the conversations you have with people are just are crazy. So, yeah, man.
Yeah. It makes for a much better interview, much more interesting than a question answer thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Well, it's interesting too. Usually I'll go through, I'll look at a band's, I'll look at a Wikipedia or you know what I mean? I do research, right? I guess you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I'm no fucking journalist, but I guess that's what you're supposed to do. But today, am I going to go Google my friend Anthony? I really have to do that? So I don't have any notes, but I figure we got lots to talk about.
Yeah, for sure. And it's good timing, too, because we just announced
a
new record and the tour and all that.
So Vacancy.
Yeah.
And when does it come out so the people... No?
Oh, shit. I guess I should know that. I think it's August 19th, but I guess I'll double check that.
Okay, cool. So it's crazy how far in advance you announce records now.
I know.
4 months. That's so nuts.
You know what's crazy, too? The record's coming out kind of end of summer, just before the fall,
Yep.
And sorry if I'm seeing distracted. I'm just double checking the release date. I'm Googling. Now I'm actually Googling myself.
You're Googling yourself. Yes.
Yeah. It's August 19th. Yeah.
Perfect.
So, it's funny how these things work. And I know that you can definitely relate the record's coming out late summer before the fall. Really, there's a lot of bands that we're all friends with. Yellow Card's in the studio right now. TBS is in the studio right now.
Yeah.
Every Time I Die's in the studio right now. All those, if you're in the studio now, it's more for a fall release.
Yeah.
And we obviously want to tour around the record. And the fall, as you know, is just such a busy touring season. So for the last 5 years have not done a fall tour. We stay off the road in the fall. Just stay away from all the traffic.
I think it's smart. Yeah.
Yeah. We do spring tours pretty much every year. And
we take it with Silverstein. We take it a step further and we do dead of the winter. We'll go out the second week of January because no one's touring then.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. Well, you guys are conditioned for that.
That's right. Damn right. Damn right we are. But no. What's going to happen then? If the record comes out August, you have this tour with headlining tour with Menzingers. I saw too. Is that around the record release?
Yeah, it starts a week before the record comes out. The record will come out, I think, in the second week of the tour. And so it's funny. So we wanted to avoid that fall touring season. So this is actually considered rushing the record out, and we're announcing it. It just got mastered today's Friday. It just got mastered on Wednesday. When we announced it and everything, we didn't even have the final mixes in yet.
Yeah. Well, it takes so long to press vinyl too. That's a big thing now.
Yeah. And that's what it all comes down to.
Yeah. It's on Hopeless again?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Great people at Hopeless. I know them all very well.
Yeah. We would have put the release out in 2 months, if it was up to us, we would have put the release out in 2 months and done an earlier summer tour. But the reason we even have to wait the 4 months is, like you said, it's vinyl, and vinyl is just too important nowadays to kind of ignore. You really got to revolve the release around it.
Sure. Well, the other thing too, bands typically in our world, don't really do summer tours unless it's Warped Tour or one of those kinds of things. So you guys are being smart, putting the record out not in the fall and not in the middle of the summer because, Warped Tour's I think pretty much done at that point, right? Warped Tour's done by the second week of August or something.
Yeah, I think Warped Tour ends the week before our tour. Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. So that's really smart thinking. Good work, Anthony.
Yeah, we're trying to fit it into that little pocket, There's like a little, and then right when everybody goes back to school is kind of a hard time to tour because people are busy and broke and all that. So it kind of, we're trying to fit it right into that pocket. But now that Blink-182 announced their stupid tour like right at the same time. So there's like one show where we're in the same city at the same time and we're like, okay, we got to try. So I think we're trying to do something about that. I think we're trying to get the, we're trying to get their show canceled or something.
Tell them they got to move.
Yeah. I mean, our show is up first, right?
Well, maybe you can like go check out the show or something. You know, I don't know. That would be cool too. I don't know if you're a Blink fan.
I've never really been a Blink fan.
No, no,
not really.
It was weird, man. Back in like high school, we're about the same age. It was like Blink wasn't really that. Like they weren't really that cool, you know.
Yeah,
and then
I think we
all
missed
of
the
a
boat
sudden, yeah, and then all of a sudden, all the younger generations like talks about Blink like they're, you know, the second coming of, you know, it's like they're like legends. And I'm like, well, they're, I guess they got some cool tunes, but like, they weren't like the best band, you know, when like Dude Ranch came out or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Dude Ranch was cool. And by the time, like you said, by the time that they really had their moment, like, I think I was too steeped in punk rock to listen to the punk rock band that was on TRL at the time.
Exactly.
You know? Like, I think I was too punk for that at that point. I think people our age kind of missed the boat on it, maybe.
Maybe. Oh, I remember they played a tour. I'm sure it came to New York. It was like a huge amphitheater tour, and Bad Religion opened for them.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you remember that. Yeah. And I was like all pissed, you know. Like, my little teenage punk rock self was like, this is not right, man.
Yeah. And now that's us in ways, you know. I don't know if you guys deal with the same thing. I see that too when we take out bands. And it's like, why are you opening for Bayside? Bayside's like this and that. Like, why are you opening for them?
No, I think it's the other way around. When you open for like a younger band, then people are like, no way, man. Bayside's been around for 15 years. They got all these records. They're a way better band. They're like legends, dude. And yeah. And then you're like, what? The younger band's like bigger and they have younger fans and we want to be here.
Right. We've only done that once. We've only done that once and it was a total disaster. And we kind of swore it off forever. We opened for, it was in Europe, and we opened for A Day to Remember in Europe, which at this point, I mean, those guys have been around for a long time. It's weird to call them the younger band, but.
But at the time they were. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it was a disaster. It was such a train wreck. We were getting booed every night. We were like, all right, this is like, we have to swear off. Like there's a lot of lessons in this.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you guys are not, I mean, Day to Remember is like, heavy fucking band, like Double Kick.
Dude, it scared us off so much that, dude, I shit you not, the minute we landed from coming back from that tour, I had an email waiting for me that I had got on the flight home that, you know, I opened when we landed.
Yes.
From our agent there saying that Dropkick Murphys wanted us to come back with them, go to Europe with them, which would have been a rad tour.
Sure.
You know, in hindsight for us, like that's a much better fit. But we were like so scared off by it. I was like, you know what? We just got booed by like 4,000 like 16-year-old kids for a few weeks. Like, I don't know if I want to go back and get booed by like 7,000 like drunk adults. You know, like that. You know what I mean? Like,
that's crazy, man.
I can handle like the younger kids, like not getting what we're doing. You know, or at least like the kids who are into that heavier, you know, younger kids who are into the heavier music, not getting what we're doing. I was like, I don't want to go like that. Like a German Dropkick crowd turns on you, like that's bad news. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's so crazy to me, man, because I feel like, was this happening in Germany or more UK?
It was more UK. It was for sure.
Yeah.
More UK.
I could see that. Cause in Germany, I feel like they're way less, they care way less about like the labels and stuff. You know, they're like, is it loud? Does it have guitars? And they're like, that I like, you know, they aren't like really that worried about the oh, well, that's a metal core band and that's a death core band or like whatever bullshit. I don't even know what that is, you know, stuff. I feel that way. So I'm surprised that happened to you guys. Were all the other bands on the tour like super heavy?
It was just us. Pierce the Veil was opening. It was Pierce the Veil and us and A Day to Remember. And Pierce the Veil had it pretty rough too, to be honest.
Crazy.
Which now, if that tour happened, it would be, everybody would love it. You know what I mean? But they even had it pretty rough too. I think it was Day to Remember's moment over there. They were really starting to blow up. And I think it was a lot of people who were just so psyched. I don't think anybody really would have loved to have that spot. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, everybody was just so psyched to see Data Remember at that moment.
Yeah, it's so amazing. It's so amazing how that happens, how people like fight and, you know, and kick and scream to try to get an opening slot, and then oops.
Yeah, right. I know. And then, you know, you learn that over the years, though. More people, like a big support tour, more people doesn't mean better show.
That's true. That's very true.
It's weird. I mean, I know you did those Avril Lavigne shows and stuff like that. I don't know how that was for you, but
yeah,
like, you know, playing in front of a ton of people doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make 10,000 new fans every day.
No, and well, we kind of fucked that up too. I'll tell the people that story because they won't understand it. With Avril Lavigne, yeah, Silverstein supported Avril Lavigne in Japan. This would have been like 2008, and this was like a huge tour, right, man? Like it was. We played the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah, know? I remember. It was like crazy.
And then that was one Tokyo show. Then we did two more, like 20,000 arenas. So I don't even know. That's like 75,000 tickets in one city. So it was insane. But it was cool because when we played, no one knew what the hell was going on. Like, I think most people there probably had never even heard a band scream before.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, makes sense.
And it was the wild thing to me was like, at first we're like, okay, we're opening for Avril Lavigne. It's a good opportunity. We're going to play like our, you know, the softer stuff, you know? And then it was going over like fine. Like people were respectful and, you know, in Japan, they're like dead quiet between songs and it's weird. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden one day, like four or five shows in, we're like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's just play like a ripping support set like we would if we were opening for A Day to Remember.
Right.
And we did it, and it went over way better.
Yeah. Huh,
and like at first, you know, in the show, I'd be like screaming and they'd be kind of weirded out. And then at the end of the set, I would like let out a scream and they would all cheer.
Nice. Yeah.
It was so weird, dude. But but at the same time, you're right. Like, we kind of fucked it up as we didn't like go. We should have went back like 6 months later. You know what I mean? We should have done that. We didn't go back for like 4 years or something. And after, you know, when that, you know, long has passed, I don't know. I think we kind of missed the boat, but hey, whatever.
Yeah, it's tough. You know what I mean? And we've thought about those things before, you know, like at this point we haven't done a support tour in like 5 years. It's just kind of not really our bag anymore. It's sort of more living on kind of an island these days. You know what I mean? Which works for us?
Manhattan or no, you're in Nashville.
At the moment I'm in Nashville.
Yeah, no, that's crazy you say that though, the Bayside Island, because you guys are kind of in a bit of your own world, you know, where... And I mean that in a good way. Like, you know,
yeah,
you guys have
it's
a real...
It's by design. It is definitely by design.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Well, I mean, it was... I guess at first, it took us a while to realize we did all these support tours over the years. I mean, we opened for Fall Out Boy. We opened for Mest and Juliana Theory and Hawthorne Heights with you. You know, like, we did all that stuff. And we never came off of any of those tours being any bigger. And we just kind of noticed more and more, like... The fans that we had that were coming to our headline shows, like, they were really just Bayside fans. You couldn't really like put them in a category of like, well, they like Bayside and this band and this band or what, you know what I mean? It's like they like Bayside and Alkaline Trio, and those are the two shows they go to all year. You know what I mean? Like that's who our fans are. So we were just like, well, fuck it. Like, why are we wasting our time with like trying to piggyback? You know, like, let's just do our own thing. You know.
Yeah, no, and I mean, you guys have done very well, and that's interesting. You say that it took you a while to kind of figure that out, because it was, you know, most bands, they kind of have like, you know, their first record does well, then their second record kind of blows up, and then like that's definitely what happened with Silverstein and what happened with like, you know, A Day to Remember, to bring them up for the fifth time.
Yeah,
but you know, with you guys, it seemed like your second record sort of got people talking, and then when you put your third and fourth records out, and you put them out kind of near, like, I remember them coming out feeling like, really, another Bayside record already?
Right, yeah.
But when those records came out and they were really good, I felt like that's when people took notice. You know, after Shudder, you know, Walking Wounded and then Shudder, I felt like that was when you're like, oh shit, this band is... You know, like, you really started developing that fan base.
Well, I mean, it's funny, because with being on Victory, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people didn't really realize what we were, you know, like I talked to a lot of people who, our own agent picked us up when the third record came out, and he told me the first time we met that like he never even listened to us until that third record because he assumed he knew what it sounded like.
Right.
You know, and like I was just with the NoFX guys like 2 days ago, and even those guys said the same thing. Same exact thing. Like it took a few records for them, or like they were in somebody's car and it was playing and they were like, what is this? Like, yeah. this is what Bayside sounds like.
Right.
You know, so it was, and so that was sort of like, you know, the slow, steady build that we've had, it was definitely a blessing, you know, cause it's helped us to have like the longevity and kind of become what we are. But I think it was the fault of like trying to fit into a scene that we weren't fitting into.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. But at the same time, you're still kind of a part of it, I think. You know, they're like, I mean, maybe it's just a Silverstein Bayside, like, you know,
yeah.
Us touring together so much because we go back and Victory and everything. But I still see like probably way more, like more Bayside shirts at our shows than maybe any other band.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah. So I mean, I know we did the co-headline tour and we were both like, yeah, it was cool, you know, but definitely we have so many of the same fans, you know, for whatever reason. And
you guys were like one of the first bands we ever befriended.
Do you remember the first day we met, Anthony?
Yeah, in Columbus.
Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, we were both playing separate shows in Columbus.
Well, no, that's
didn't we
not
meet
right.
like on the street? We met like walking down the street, right?
I know the story
so
pretty
you guys
well.
You guys look like a band.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's not what happened. We rolled in to this venue. It was called like Bernie's or something.
Mm-hmm.
And we like didn't really know anything about the show, right? And we knew we were playing with you guys. So we were like there and it was just the two bands and the promoter was being weird. And then we found out there was another show down the street and it was with like Branson and Love Drug.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these, right? So we're like, well, hey, can we just combine these shows? You know, it'll be like a 5-band bill and it'll be like way better. And I think Branson was the headliner and they didn't want to do it. So we're like, fuck. So what we ended up doing, if you can recall this, and this is 2003 for the people listening, we actually ended up making like posters and walking around the Ohio State campus and handing out flyers for our show. And it was just, and the show ended up, we couldn't join the shows together. And we only had, we probably had 20, 25 people at our show.
Yeah, but not a bad show.
Friends ever since.
Not a bad show for
those days. It actually was pretty good. Yeah,
yeah. We weren't even signed yet at that point. I think you guys had just signed to Victory. I'm not even sure if your record was out yet.
It had like just maybe it hadn't come out yet. That was like one of our first tours, maybe our first US tour ever.
Yeah, and that's a long time ago, man.
Yeah, it is a long time ago. It's crazy, man.
And then we did, and then after we signed a Victory, and our record wasn't even out yet, we did the full US tour together. We were playing in like barns and shit.
Yeah, that was the first time we'd ever went to the West Coast actually with you guys. And I remember you guys were playing because you know when you're new bands. I remember we played a show specifically at like Omaha, at like a bowling alley.
Yeah,
and there was two bands, just us and you guys. You guys played 5 songs. We played 7, and that was the show.
And I remember, do you know what I remember about that Omaha show? Me and Bill, in an effort to try and make the show interesting for ourselves, me and Bill were trying to compete with who could wear more layers of clothing on stage. So the two of us played with like, sweatshirts and jackets and scarves and hats on and shit just to fucking make each other laugh.
So funny.
The Ranch Bowl in Omaha.
The Ranch Bowl, that's the name. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's crazy, man. And yeah, that was like crazy back in those days. You know, you had Jim playing drums and Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
Do you keep in touch with those guys anymore?
Nope. Well, Jim, nope. Jim, we do. I saw Jim comes out to the shows. He lives in San Francisco now. He comes out to the shows sometimes, and we hang. And he was at Jack's wedding. That was cool. We got to spend, you know, so we spent like a whole day and night together at Jack's wedding.
Right.
Andrew, I don't really talk to at all. I'm not sure where he is.
That's cool. No, I remember the dynamic was interesting back then too, because Andrew was, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I actually, he told me that he kind of was the lyricist in the early days, like on
he
the
was.
Sirens
yeah.
and Condolences record.
Yeah, he wrote the lyrics on that record. Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, this is obviously the Lead Singer Syndrome, you know, podcast. So we talk right. a lot about that stuff, like writing lyrics and writing melodies and stuff like that, you know. And I always think it's strange when obviously you're the chief songwriter in the band, you write the music, to have somebody come in and did you just take like his notebook and kind of adapt the words?
Yeah,
or how did
exactly,
that work?
Exactly. And it was awesome at the time. It was like, I mean, for one, writing lyrics now is so fucking stressful. You know what I mean? I like labor over them. But at the time it was awesome because I just write a song all instrumental. And then I would, yeah, literally he would just give me his notebooks and I would go through them and I would come up with melodies. Like I already have kind of melodies in place, but I would just be singing like la 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 over them. And I would just replace the la la la's with his lyrics, you know. I would just kind of start singing his notebooks.
Yeah.
And it was fun. It was definitely a fun way to do it. And then when he left the band, I was a little bit like, oh fuck, like can I write lyrics? Because everybody liked his lyrics, you know.
Yeah.
That was like on the first record, that was like a kind of a big part of the band. And I was like, fuck, can I write lyrics like that? And then, you know, okay, it worked out, I guess.
It definitely worked out. No, I actually remember that thinking that to myself. You know, when the self-titled record came out, your second record, thinking to myself, huh, I guess Anthony's going to write the words now, and is it going to be, like, way different, you know?
Because
the first record, it's fucking dark, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess in a way he inspired you with those notebooks to kind of figure out, you know, how to write a bass, you know? Like, it's kind of a weird thing now.
He was a real, why, before he was in the band, I was writing the lyrics. And, you know, it's nothing, they're nothing that I'm like super proud of. And when he joined the band and started showing me these notebooks, I was like, wow, well, what you're doing is way better than what I'm doing. So let's use yours. But yeah. And then when he left, like, I guess I could say now that I did probably learn something from his writing.
No, that's cool. No, I always wanted to ask you about that. And, you know, because, yeah, for me, like, it's funny you say you labor over lyrics, because I'm the same way, man. Like, I'll sit in my house and I'll stare at my notepad for like an hour. And if I come up with like four lines of a verse in an hour, I'll be like, yeah, that's good. I'm done for the day.
Oh, totally. Yeah. If you write one verse in a day, like, that's a good day of work.
Yeah. I know. It's crazy. And I talked to some singers, they just like, I don't know how they do it. They just shit it out. Like, it's like crazy.
Oh, I feel like about just songwriting in general, man. I like Brian Fallon from Gaslight and John Foreman from Switchfoot. Those two dudes, like when I talk to them and they're working on a record, they'll be like, I wrote like 40 songs. So we're just going to get in the studio and see and kind of pick the best ones. I'm like, how do you write 40 songs? You know, like,
I can't do it.
I mean, neither. We put 11 songs on a record and I write 11 songs, you know, like we don't have like a bunch of B-sides or anything. I don't know.
I'm the same way, man. Because part of it is like, okay, if you're going to write 40 songs, okay, and you're going to pick 10, why are you wasting 30 songs? Like, what, you're just going through the motions on a song you know isn't really that great?
I think so, because, you know, I don't. Have you ever had Conley on your show, Chris Conley?
No, I would love to talk
to him. You should, because he's like probably he's like a guru, you know? He likes, he speaks in like one-liners, you know? it's like brilliant. But that's one of his big things, is like he always sees a song through. See, if the way I am, and I think the way you are, if you start working on a song and you're not in love with it, you just ditch it. You know, if it's not good, you just ditch it.
No,
you start working on something else. Chris's whole thing is like he wants to write a song every day, and he wants to keep his writing chops up. And if he doesn't love something, he tries to not over scrutinize it. Like, he just sees it through. Like, he'll finish it by the end of the day, and maybe 6 months from now he'll listen to it and be like, oh wow, if I change that chord, then it's a much better song.
Yeah. I feel like the problem with that, though, is like at the core of songwriting too, though, like obviously it's our job and this is like what we do for money and stuff like that, right? But I still have to feel inspired, and I still have to feel like some kind of magic, you know? I feel like there's some kind of magic kind of has to happen. So if I was going to say, all right, I'm going to write a song a day for the next, like, 2 weeks. I'm going to write 14 songs. I don't think I'm going to wake up every day and be like, okay, this is, like, I feel like this is going to be good today. You know what
right.
I mean? And then
yeah.
it almost ends up being more, like, scientific than artistic.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that. I mean, like, I've been asked to do, like, ever since coming to Nashville. I've never really been very interested in the co-writing scene.
Oh, yeah, but, in Nashville. Shit, you got to do it.
Yeah, I've never really been that interested. And then ever since, like, getting the place here, people just call, you know? You don't even, like, really try. You don't try yeah. to get involved. People just, they know you're around and they know you're a writer. And people, especially, like, being in Bayside and stuff, there are people who kind of grew up on the band and stuff who now are, like, country singers or writers or whatever, and they like,
well, don't downplay your ability as a songwriter. I mean, I know you know what you're doing.
Yeah,
but continue.
So I've gone to a couple of them, and it's the weirdest scene, man. You sit there for like 6 hours with two other people, and like you write a song in 6 hours, and like you need to yep. leave the session with a song because they have another session at night and they have another session in the morning where they have right. to write two more songs, you know. And I'm just like, man, I can't write like that. It takes me like 3 months to write a song. I can't write like in one sitting. I also can't write with other people in the room.
Maybe it's not for you, man.
It's definitely not for me. I like, you know, we figured out like Bayside's way of collaborating on songs. Like I work on songs on my own at home, come up with like sort of a basic idea and chords and melodies and stuff like that. And I give it to the band and then they help to shape it into like a Bayside song. And that works for us, but like I can't, like we've tried to like write at practice or write in the studio, like all in the same room, and I can't do it. Like I need to sort of like be engulfed in it, you know?
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. I totally know what you mean. Although I will say that once in a while you can kind of have that moment where there's like five guys where you're like almost jamming
mm-hmm.
and then there'll be something cool. And like I'd say like with Silverstein, we probably have, you know, if we have 12 songs on a record, probably like two of them will come out of it just from kind of fucking around.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel like those songs are different and like in a good way, like they're kind of the fun songs. And then they end up being the songs everyone likes the best.
Right.
Cause everyone kind of had a hand in them. So I think that stuff is can be kind of cool too.
We'll do that on parts and stuff like that. Like
yeah.
but I kind of need the song to be there. And then if we go in and we say, oh, the verse feels dull or whatever, like we'll jam on the verse for a yeah. few hours and kind of see if anything takes shape, you know.
But, yeah,
like,
but
I can't go
are...
in with no chords. I can't go in and just be like, I don't know, here's a thing. You know, I can't do it that way.
Have you talked to you said you were hanging out with NOFX the other day. Have you talked to Fat Mike about songwriting ever?
Briefly, and I think we only really realized the other day that they and this is even more from talking to like the crew about it, cuz it's a little hard for me to get time with him because I'm like you know me for a long time. I don't do drugs. I don't drink. I don't like. You
it's
know
hard to
mean?
Get time with them because you don't do
I'm
drugs.
I'm not a partier. I don't even stay up late. You know what I mean? Like you've known
right.
me for a long time. I'm
yep.
like for I'm like no not even a beer after the show. Like straight to bed.
Yeah,
rest my vocal cords for tomorrow kind of person. And like and that's not to say he just parties too much for me to hang out with. But those are his hours. You know what I mean? If you want to chill with him, you're chilling with him like. After the show later on, you know, I was with like the crew guys all day and I think Mike was asleep. Like we met up at like around 1 for lunch and they had a book signing later in the day. And at like, say it was like 7 o'clock and Mike woke up at like 6, you know what I mean? It's like, I just didn't even see him before he had to go do his thing.
Yeah. I just bring it up because, you know, back on Warped Tour, you know, I'm a poker player, you know, I'm not a drug guy either, but, you know, I'm a big poker player and we used to play poker like every night on the Warped Tour back in, was it 2009 you guys did it when it was us, you guys and NOFX? I think it was 2009.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And I remember, you know, I used to talk to Fat Mike all the time and talking to him about songwriting is like crazy.
Like he's the real deal, man.
Like the some of the stuff he does is like insane with, mm-hmm. with chords and melody. And he was actually talking about you one time at the poker table. Just like it was kind of like what you said earlier about being like, oh, I don't know. I like thought, you know, I thought this band was this certain way, and then I actually heard them and I realized that they weren't. And he was like kind of blown away with you know, some of your chord progressions and melodies as well.
Yeah,
you know?
I think that's why
I asked you if you'd ever talk to him specifically.
It's funny. There's a big mutual respect there that I don't know that like that I realized until more recently. Until I hear people be like, "Yeah, Mike was talking about like your songwriting." I'm like, "Really, Mike? Like Fat Mike from NoFX was talking about like he knows like my chord progressions."
Right,
you know what I mean. So I think we're kind of both just learning that like we're sort of cut from the same cloth as far as songwriting goes. We're both
big fans
of that like real weird whimsical sort of, you know, chord progressions and like the sort of vocal melodies that go on tangents. You know what? You know what? Actually, I was talking about with NoFX the other day is so many of their songs don't have choruses. And you don't really realize that. And somebody was telling me a story that, like, Mike was talking to somebody about that. And they were like, "Yeah, what do you mean? Of course you have choruses." And he's like, "Yeah, name a song. What's the chorus?" You know, like, Linoleum does not have a chorus.
No.
Crazy.
I know. That's the thing, though. You can learn so much from that band and their songs. That's why they're one of my favorite bands. I know they're one of your favorite bands, too. So,
yeah.
You know? It's crazy, man. But
yeah, Mike's the real deal. I don't think a lot of people really realize that either.
Have you read the book?
I'm like halfway through it right now.
Yeah, I'm about halfway through it too. It's fucked.
Yeah. It is fucking gnarly, man. It is so gnarly. I was out the other night with Chad and Haley, and I was talking about the book, and I had only read like the first maybe 25 pages at that point, where it was only just talking about their childhood. I was like, it's so fucking gnarly. And they haven't even like started NoFX yet, and it's so fucking gnarly. And like we all know, like what happens after that. You know, we all know, like with the newer stories of their like of their debauchery or whatever.
Oh well, yeah, because a lot of it was on TV.
Yeah. And so now, and I was like, I haven't even gotten past like them being teenagers, and it's so fucking gnarly already.
I know. It's crazy.
It's great, though. It's great because it's the book is great because it's not just like I don't know if you agree, but it's not like shock value at all. It really is like pretty riveting, and it's a fucking great story.
Yeah, it is. It is. It really is. And like it's there's something real about it too. You know, it's like it's I don't know if I'm describing this badly, but there's something real about it in that they're like real people and they're real kids. It's not like the Motley Crue book where they're like. Just total douchebag rock stars that don't care.
Right,
like they seem to care, you know, in a way. Like they want to get fucked up and get laid, you know, in the book, like they say that. But in the Motley Crue, it's like they're almost like bad people, kind of.
Right.
You know what I mean? Whereas like NoFX, it doesn't seem like they're not bad people. It's just a lot of crazy shit happened. And
I think
it's
also real interesting. It's interesting to find out how they became how they are. You know, like this, the road to it and what their childhoods were like and what it was. I mean, I love all the stuff about growing up in like the LA punk scene in the '80s. That shit's super interesting to me.
Absolutely, man. Well, let's, first time on the show. And I don't know if I know much about this for you. So will you talk about your upbringing in New York?
Yeah, I grew up in Queens and, it was pretty normal. I grew up in like an apartment, like a two bedroom apartment, me and my brother and my mom and dad. And we were there like until, I guess I lived there until I like moved out pretty much in this in this like two bedroom apartment in Queens. It was in like a little neighborhood called Glen Oaks. It was right by Bayside. And, yeah, I mean, and it was kind of normal. I played Little League, you know. I've always been really into baseball. I know me and you talk about baseball a lot. I was really into baseball, and then I started playing guitar when I was like 9, and started like playing in punk bands. There was a library close by that like used to do punk shows like every other month or so.
In the basement
of the library.
Yep.
So my first band was called the Flame and Moe's. From The Simpsons, because like every band name has to be a Simpsons reference, we played our first show at the Great Neck Library, and
were you singing at this point or just playing guitar?
I never sang until we started Bayside. We started Bayside via a Long Island like scene message board that somebody was trying to put together an Operation Ivy tribute, and I was playing in like a band at the time, and you know, the guys I was playing with wasn't, you know, they weren't really trying to do it seriously, and I met these three other guys on the message board who were also in bands with guys who weren't trying to take it seriously. So we were like, well, let's just start our own band, and like, we'll go on tour and everything, you know?
Cool.
So yeah, so we all met up, and we just kind of, we all met up at like, the night we met up for our first practice was like the first time we all met each other. We had just like talked on like this message board.
Sure. Yeah. It's funny how that, you know, that's, I guess that's now how it works too. It's just like Facebook or something, but
yeah,
it's funny so, how so long ago it was still kind of the same thing, still using the internet in its primitive,
yeah,
very primitive
yeah, it
time.
It was definitely an AOL, like a via AOL for sure.
Yeah.
And yeah. we all met up and everybody kind of played the songs that they had and like songs that they had written and like sang them. And everybody's like, well, like you can hit the highest notes, so you're the singer. You know, I guess
crazy,
you should sing.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, I guess I'll be the singer. And I'd like never sang in a band before the first bass I'd practice.
So funny. Yeah, that's so crazy. So you say you're in a guitar.
Did you sing before Silverstein? Were you always a singer?
Dude, the same story, man. And I love these podcasts. I talk to people, it's the same story. I got a guitar, I was probably about 10. My dad played guitar, so there's always like acoustic guitars laying around the house. So
yeah.
You know, my dad would play and sing and stuff. And I heard Metallica, pretty much the story. I heard Metallica and I wanted to do that. I didn't even know if it was guitar or drums. I just knew it was heavy. And my sister's like, I think it's guitar. I'm like, all right, I'll get a guitar. And, and you know, like the chugging, you know what I mean? I didn't know what that was.
Right.
If it was like double kick or if it was guitar. And I got a guitar and literally like just took guitar lessons and got pretty good. And then again, yeah, joined up with a bunch of friends. And literally I was the only person that could carry a tune.
Yeah.
So I just by default was a singer and I never wanted to be. And then, you know, I always was a guitar player first and now I don't even play guitar in Silverstein. So it's kind of weird, but yeah, that's my story.
I listened to your episode with that Adam Lazaro was on.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And
yeah, he's a bass player, right?
Yeah.
It's
it was like
how
the
weird
same
is that?
Story. They were like, you're going to add that Eddie just like pointed at him. It was like, you're going to be the singer.
Like, yeah, I laughed
like
my
singer,
ass off when he said
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the singer quit, and Eddie's just like, you're going to be the singer. He's like, I guess I could figure out how to do it.
Yeah, I know, man. It's really funny, though, how you know, we're from all different walks of life, you know what I mean, and different places, and it all just seems like the same kind of story, you know? And it's I always find that interesting. But so you got a guitar when you were 9. How did that come about? What kind of drew you to that?
It's actually a hilarious story. I had just gotten Nevermind. Nevermind had just come out.
Awesome.
And
what a record.
Oh yeah.
I still listen to it like every month.
Oh God, I loved it. And like there was a girl that I told I was 9, so what are you in like the sixth like the fourth grade or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
And there was a girl that I told that I knew how to play Smells Like Teen Spirit. and you know, all the kids thought that was so cool, which like clearly I didn't. I didn't even know how to play the guitar. But I told everybody that, and everybody thought I was really cool because of it. So I like begged my parents to get me a guitar and get me lessons. They're like, all right, I have to learn it now. Like, I have to learn it or else everybody's going to find out. Everybody's going to figure out that I was lying. So, so I got a guitar, and then, the rest is history, as they say. Just
so
kind of never looked
how
back.
How long till you actually learned Smells Like Teen Spirit so you
first
could show
lesson.
Your friends?
First,
nice.
Well,
oh, good.
Well,
you
know,
up
first
pretty
lesson,
quick.
I was learning, like, how to hold a pick and stuff like that, you know? But definitely the first song we learned, after I learned how to play a power chord, the first song was, I was like, I have to learn Smells Like Teen Spirit.
I feel like the first riff everyone learned that's our age is the Come As You Are riff.
Yeah, yep, that's a good one.
Yeah, that one, that's like everyone's first riff. Yeah, back if you're you know, between the ages of 30 and 36, probably.
That's it. And then Green Day, and then Dookie came out shortly mm-hmm. after that, and
right.
Smash, and then
exactly,
was, and
those
then
records,
was,
man.
And then it was punk, and punk and Drublick around that time, and,
yep.
So, and then it was just punk. It was punk from then on.
Punk.
Yeah, I was always more into, so like throughout high school, I was more into like, well, obviously I loved all the Fat stuff and the Epitaph stuff, like I know you did also.
Sure, yeah.
And I was always into more like the street punk stuff and the Oi stuff. Like, always been a big Toy Dolls fan and Angelic Upstarts and Oxymoron and stuff. That was always my scene. Cool. But in New York, like, the hardcore thing was starting to really like brew, you know? So like, me and my friends were kind of like nerds for like in punk rock, instead of like when we'd go to St. Mark's, which is where all like the punks and the hardcore kids hung out when I was in high school. And, that's where there was like all the clubs were over there, like in the Bowery, like St. Mark, like there was Coney Island High and CB's and all that. So we were going to those places in high school, and that's when kind of Madball was happening and stuff like that.
Sure, of course.
And so we were like kind of nerds for having spiky hair and shit like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was like that here too. I mean, even Toronto was like that. There was definitely a big division between like punk rock and like the straight edge vegan hardcore scene, you know?
Yeah.
And for me, I was like, I guess I was kind of a part of both of them, but you know, not like, like a part of both of them, but also part, like kind of not a part of either one of them at the same time. You know what I mean? And I just love music. Like, I never was that caught up in the, like, I don't know. I don't even know if I had spiky hair, you know, like I just kind of didn't care about the fashion of it as much. And in some ways I still probably care even less than I did back then, you know. Mm-hmm. But I love the music, and I'd listen to, and I'd go to hardcore shows and punk shows and whatever, you know. I guess the only thing I cared about other than the music was the message, you know. Obviously, like, I know you used to be vegetarian, you know, back in the day too, and you know, so that stuff was important to me. But in terms of the fashion or like the being cool part, to me that was always like the worst thing, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, it's funny because I like being a punk kid, I really liked like 7 Seconds and Youth of Today and Minor Threat, but that was like, that was punk to me, you know what I mean? Like, that sounded like the fast punk bands that I like.
Sure.
What, like, I didn't really make that correlation that was early hardcore, you know? And
yeah,
spoken to Baker, Brian Baker, like a whole bunch of times, who's in Minor Threat, like at the outset of the straight edge movement. And we've spoke a lot about like where straight edge has gone compared to where it was, you know. He was telling me, like, he said there was like straight edge scenes. Yeah, well, he was saying back then there were straight edge scenes where kids did like smoke and drink. It wasn't like as hardline as it is now. It was more
crazy.
It was more like it was more like a mentality, you know what I mean? It was more like, don't be a shithead, you know what I mean? It's kind of where it's become more like, not a drop of anything, you don't touch anything. And you know, there's definitely something to be said about that. I think at its heart it's still a pretty great movement, you know, but it definitely, you know, it's gotten a little weird, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, with some of the like straight edge gangs and stuff, I guess, and like some of the violence, that's some of that stuff's pretty fucking fucked up and crazy. But no, I agree with you, man. Like, there's nothing wrong with not getting fucked up. Like, let's not be stupid here,
right?
You know, but I think it's funny that you say that, because that always happens. Somebody puts it out, and now like the lyrics for like straight edge or out of step, you know, like those old Minor Threat songs, like people like treat them like they're scripture.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I know there's the one line in, I think it's Out of Step, the song, when it's like, don't smoke, don't drink, don't fuck, at least I can fucking think.
Yeah.
So then there was like the whole, oh, well, if you're straight edge, you can't have sex. Do you remember that? That
right,
was like
a
thing too.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, just because Ian McKay or Mackay, I don't know how you say it, just because he put that in that song, that line, like he could have sat there like we do in our apartments pondering the lyrics and been like, huh, I'm gonna change that word, and then strategy would be completely different,
right?
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's
but
interesting,
whatever.
Yeah, so I mean that was pretty much high school to me. We would just take the train from Queens into Manhattan and like hang out on St. Mark's, go to shows at Coney Island High and CB's, and that, you know, and that was my goal at the time with my bands. It was just like, man, it'd be so cool to get real gigs in Manhattan, you know, play at Coney Island High or play at CB's or something like that. You know, it's funny.
Yeah.
I've said it's really funny. I feel like you're probably in a similar boat where, you know, I've been going through sort of a really great realization in my life where I'm just super satisfied with like where I am and what I've done. And like a lot of the like wanting has like sort of like faded away. Which,
cool.
You know,
that's
because
really
I'm just
cool.
So, I'm just so satisfied with like my daughter and you know, my bills are paid, and they're all paid through playing music, and I get to play music every day, and I get to make a record every other year, and I get to go on tour and play shows, and that's my life. And the success has gotten to a point where I'm satisfied. You know what I mean? If we're to get bigger, then cool. If not, cool, whatever. You know what I mean? I'm satisfied.
Absolutely, man.
In that sort of process, I've realized, like, man, like, I kind of feel like our band is bigger than, like, almost any band I grew up listening to.
Yeah, that's that's a very weird realization to think about that. Yeah. Like, I remember thinking, I forget who it was that I met, but it was somebody in an old band I used to listen to. And I kind of was talking to them, and I noticed they were sort of sucking up to me. You know what I mean? And this is weird. I was like, this band is like way bigger than my band. And then I actually, you know, when you actually think about, you know, the venues you saw the band play in, and then, you know, you see how many records they really sold, and you're like, I guess it wasn't that big. But, you know, but your perception of it is like way different, you know, now. So... or back then. It's crazy, man. It's a crazy thing.
Yeah. I mean, CB's only held like 400 or 500 people, you know, and that would have been, I saw Bad Religion on the Gray Area tour there. And I just remember thinking like, God, this is crazy. This is the biggest show I've ever, like at that time, it was like the biggest show I'd ever been to.
Yeah. Well, Bad Religion did some big stuff too. I mean, maybe they were just really big in Canada because that kind of music is just huge here, but no, I know what you mean, man. And it's wild, but that's like really a really cool thing to hear from you to say that you're just satisfied and you're just content. And it's because, and part of it, you know, is like, you know, back when we were on Victory, which I want to talk about a little bit in a second, but you know, when we were in those days, it was like, all you were ever thinking about is how can we get bigger?
Yeah.
Like every step of the way, it's like, what can we do to get bigger? What can we, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
And when you realize, like, you know, yeah, you, I don't know, what are you, 33, 34 now?
33.
Yeah. Did you forget?
You know what? Like a couple of months ago, I told somebody I was 32 and I was totally serious. I like actually forgot.
Yeah, it happens. It happened to me at like a casino one time. I was walking in and they asked me how old I was, and I said the wrong age. I showed them that. I was like, I'm not lying. I don't remember. No, I think it was my girlfriend at the time was like, no, you're not. I was like, oh yeah, shit. I'm 30. I'm actually, yeah.
It's so weird.
But what I'm saying is like, you get to this age and you know, if you can be happy, where you're at, you know, and you're not trying to live this fucking pipe dream where you're like, maybe our song's going to get to radio and it's going to go to number one.
Yeah,
and so once you kind of leave that all behind and you're just happy with who you are, what you are and what you're doing, then I think that's the key, you know, I think that's the key to, you know, being happy, which I guess is everything, right?
Yeah, dude, there was a real sort of turning point in that for me when we were doing, when we had the Killing Time record out, we were on Wind Up. The Sick was like at radio and it was doing pretty well. It went to like number 20 on the chart. And it was like, whoa, this is like, we're going to be like Green Day. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, we're going to be like Green Day. We're going to be a big radio punk band. And, we were fucking busting ass and we were doing all these things and these like that just sucked. And like they started to
like
wear
shitty
on
radio
us more
shows
and more.
And stuff.
Yeah. Shit like that and stupid interviews where they're asking you the stupidest questions and you have to do every single piece of press that comes through. Like nowadays I do like almost no press, but it's like you had to do every single piece of press that came through and all the stupid like playing to radio station stuff. And then we played a show in like upstate New York. I can't remember. It was like Syracuse or Rochester. I don't remember which one because we had done a couple with them. It was us and Bush and Stone Temple Pilots.
Okay.
And there was like, it was like in a field and there was like 10,000 people there. It was fucking huge. And Long Island Fest was happening like the same weekend, like at a VFW hall and I'm the Avalanche was like headlining it.
Yeah.
And we did this show and there was a fucking Confederate flag merchandise booth like at this thing.
What?
They were selling like lighters and wallets and hats and flags and shit like that. It was so shitty. I just remember thinking like we got off stage and I remember thinking like I wish I was playing Long Island Fest. Like I wish we were playing with I'm the Avalanche at a VFW hall in Long Island right now.
Right.
And that was like it. I called our manager. I was like, yo, just tell the label no, tell the label we're out, you know, like we don't do this wow. shit anymore. And we just wow. started saying no to everything, every like station visit, which you have to do when you're doing a radio campaign. Like the days just sucked. It was like getting up early in the morning to do some shitty, like wacky morning radio show.
Oh, that's
you
the
know,
worst.
Like the Man Cow so show and these like zany morning personalities.
Yeah, with dog so, and the bear.
Yeah, so stupid. And we were like doing those every morning. And then we'd go do like an in-store or something like that in the afternoon. And then we'd go do another station visit, like for an afternoon interview. And then we'd play the gig. And by the time we played the gig, it was like, fuck, like I'm fucking exhausted.
Yeah.
I got to get up at 7 for the fucking, yeah, for some stupid show.
Yeah, so, man, that's so, okay.
It sucked. So we were just, so that, and that was like a real turning point. I was like, I wish I was playing with Eye on the Avalanche at a VFW hall on Long Island instead of playing to 10,000 people, 10,000 Stone Temple Pilot fans.
It's really funny you say that, man. And you know what? I wonder if now that you guys have done that and you've left it behind, if now that's like when the success is going to come, like when you put out Vacancy,
yeah.
Now it's like all, you know what I mean? It's like brand new, you know? And I love Brand New. Don't get me wrong. Love the band. One of my favorite bands. They managed to do everything wrong.
Oh yeah.
Like
yeah.
from a career perspective.
Yeah.
And it's like they can't do anything wrong. Like they're always, they're bigger than they've ever been. People love them, but they don't care. You know?
And they don't do any press. They do shows where they play the same song twice. They like, they play venues that are too, they do full album tours where they only play 3 shows and they're in venues that nobody can, that are too small.
Yeah.
They do everything wrong. But it's fucking great because the cream rises to the top. They're a fucking amazing band.
I guess that's all you that matters
me?
In the end.
Doesn't
right?
matter. And like, yep. here's me and you spending years like scrutinizing every fucking decision, every like, you know what I mean? Scrutinizing every like, who should we take on tour? Who should we open for? Where should we play? What should our promo photos look like? And like, those guys just don't give a shit, but their music speaks for itself. And that's like the most valuable lesson that any fucking
Absolutely.
Musician can learn.
Absolutely. Well, tell me about this new record, Vacancy. It's out August 19th. What was the approach going into it, and how did it turn out?
I'm in love with it. It was the most difficult record to make by far. Like with the whole time we were laughing about. I hope we got enough time on this interview because this like Vacancy story is pretty.
Dude, I got as long as you want. We could go for another hour if you want. I don't care.
So we and this is, you know, it was cool. This is the first interview I've done on this.
Oh, nice,
cycle.
Awesome.
So this is
awesome.
Like I'm going to tell this story 100 times, but you're going to get the fresh version.
Okay,
of it.
Perfect. Yeah.
So I wrote the record about. I moved to Nashville about 2.5 years ago. With my wife at the time, and we had just had our baby, and the plan was to kind of come down. We were going to buy a house, maybe 2, as like investments, because the market is kind of yeah. really, really doing well here, and we were able to get in cheap at the time. And she was going to open a tattoo shop, and we were going to have that. And with the whole plan being, let's go down there for like a year or two, and we'll kind of plant those seeds. We'll have the shop, we'll have some houses, and then we'll move back to New York, you know what I mean? And we'll just rent out the houses. It was kind of like, that was kind of the plan, you know? And so we came down, and after a year of being here, we split up. And so it was kind of, it was fucked because I then had to stay because her family was here and she was going to stay. She had the shop and all that.
Right.
So she was like, well, there's nothing for me in New York, so I want to stay. And I was like, well, if our daughter stays here, that means I have to stay here. You know, and that was, so it was fucked. I was fucked. I was like truly, truly, truly fucked. It was so painful because I was like,
damn, dude.
Dude, do I just live here now? Like, do I just live in Tennessee? Like, alone, too? Like, I'm not married anymore. I don't really have a lot of friends here. I don't have any family here. I was like, so I just fucking live here indefinitely, like until my daughter's old enough that I can move back home. So it was a crazy, I mean, it still is. It's still going on. It's like pretty crazy, super isolated time where I was like, and I just didn't know what was going to come next. You know, it was like for the first time in a long time, like I did not know. I kind of have prided myself for a long time on having my shit together. You know what I mean? And I was like,
yeah.
And it was a moment where it was like, oh my God, I don't even know where I live. I don't even know what fucking state I live in. You know what I mean? Like, am I going to move back and like be away from my daughter, or am I going to stay here alone and just martyr myself? You know what I mean? And damn, just man. Be fucking lonely, but like do it for her. So it was a fucked, real fucked up moment. And that's, so I moved out of the house that her and I lived in, and I moved into like an apartment for a little while just to sort things out, you know, kind of signed like a short lease at an apartment just to figure out am I going to buy a new house here? Am I going to move back? Am I going to stay in this apartment? So it was in Franklin, Tennessee, and I was calling at the Franklin Hotel because people would like come over and I didn't unpack and I didn't hang anything. Cause it was just like, right. I don't even know. This is like a stopover. I don't know if I'm going to stay here. I might live here forever. I might leave next week.
This is dark times, man.
It was dark. It was real dark. Yeah. So I was calling at the Franklin Hotel, and that's where I wrote the record. I wrote Vacancy like in this apartment, and I had like a couch and a TV and my bed and my desk and my computer and my guitar, and everything else was just all my boxes of stuff, you know, just waiting to kind of figure out where they were going to go.
Right.
And I wrote the record.
I see where the title of the record comes from.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause we were calling it like it was sort of a joke at the time that it was just like the hotel, you know, and so that's where the hotel on the cover comes from.
Right. Sure.
The whole hotel theme of it. But then, you know, the Vacancy thing is sort of like double meaning, you know, cause it was like,
absolutely.
It was like the physical. Feel. Yeah. It was the physical and the emotional sort of thing I was going through. So, and that's what I wrote the record about. It is it's definitely the most cohesive record lyrically that I've ever written, for sure, where there's a theme for sure. You know, there's like the whole record really is about what I was feeling. And it's not a typical, and I really made sure I did not want to write like a typical breakup record. You know, it's not about what happened. It's not about the breakup. It's about the aftermath, really. It's about like figuring out my life afterwards, you know?
Yeah.
and it's the most lyrically honest record that I've ever written, to the point where when I play it for people now, I'm like, you know, now that it's done,
uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable when I play it for people because I'm like, oh shit, well now they know that about me. You know? It's weird. It's really uncomfortable to listen to it with like in the presence of friends.
Wow, man.
You know, because people are kind of like, wow, I didn't know it was like that, you know.
I can't wait to hear this record. This is crazy. You know, I haven't talked about this on the podcast yet, but I actually just went through a breakup myself four and a half years. Yeah, it's like the same kind of deal where I'm, you know, off my own, and it's the same thing. Like, you know, I'm at a point in my life where I'm like, fuck, like I'm 35 and you know what I mean? It's like, what am I doing
now? What?
You know what I mean? And you have your daughter and stuff. I don't have any kids or anything. So, you know, for me, it's like, I'm going through that same kind of thing where I'm trying to figure out, what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. So, you know, it's, that's crazy, man. And it's funny we're talking about this now.
But
it's just
heavy,
interesting.
Man. It's heavy. It's just interesting because without leaving the house, cause I don't have anything to do. I don't have anyone to go see. I don't have anyone to go hang out with. I don't have anything to do. I got like literally, I go days without. Like, I have my daughter. I'm real lucky, and you know, and my ex and I think have been real good about a kind of co-parenting, and you know, everything you know went kind of as smoothly as it could have from that standpoint. You know, I have 50-50 custody of my daughter, so I have her for a whole week, every other week. You know,
right.
So.
It's just interesting because you said before how content you felt, you know what I mean? And you know,
yeah, it's weird. It's weird.
So I guess it's a positive thing though in the long run. Like you can kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel, because where I'm at right now, and it's still very fresh, like it's hard for me to see the light at the end of the tunnel, you know?
Yeah. I mean, life, I think me and you have been doing this long enough though, that we know that life and your career are two different things.
Yeah, well, I guess they're supposed to be, but sometimes you wonder, you know, sometimes it's like your life seems to be your career and your career seems to be your life.
Yeah, you know? For a long time, I mean, the band was just everything, you know, and it's still, right. I still love it just as much as I ever did, but I learned how to like go home and not be in the band, you know, like go home and just be like a guy.
Yeah, that's no, man. That's something I think I struggle with, to be honest with you. So
yeah, but, it is hard, but, man. It's hard, especially being a singer. Back to the lead singer syndrome.
Yeah,
it's really hard, and a lot of people don't realize this. Even the people that are in the bands with the singers, I don't think realize you have to get on stage and be the man. You know what I mean? And then like you spend years or decades working on that. Like working on going on stage and being the fucking man, being the guy that all the other guys want to be like, you know, like that's your job, you know?
That's true. And, that's true. Yeah. And then
you get off stage and you're supposed to just turn that off. Don't think you're the man anymore. You know what I mean? Get on stage and believe in yourself, you know, but be an ultra confident, like just fucking ooze confidence to the audience while you're on stage, and then get off stage and turn the confidence off because it's off-putting to your friends. You know what I mean? It's fucking, it's fucked up. It's impossible.
You have to be humble and it's very fuck.
That's the basis of the lead singer syndrome. That's right. That's where it comes from, because you have to do interviews and play shows and fucking ooze confidence and just be the man. And then if you get off stage and you still think you're the man, now you're a dick.
That's so fucking great. You nailed it. You nailed it. It took us 6 months of this to finally figure out where this all stems from.
What is lead singer syndrome?
But we figured it out. That's the cause right there.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of people do it. A lot of people do it. Like, a lot of people can do it. You know, there's a lot of, you know that. I mean, not clearly.
Well, I mean, I remember even you. I mean, I've known you since, you know, we were both baby bands. And I mean, it took you a long time to kind of find that, like, on stage persona.
Definitely.
You know, I remember I remember one specific show. I don't remember what it was. I feel like it might have been a festival or something. And all of a sudden you're there, like, you know, getting the crowd to clap and doing like a thing where like there's a kick drum going and you're like doing vocals over it. And I was like, oh shit, Anthony like figured it out. You know what I mean?
Cause, you know,
and I guess maybe part of it's cause we come from this punk rock hardcore scene where that isn't as much a thing.
It just comes from, like I said, it comes from being able to ooze confidence, to be so hyper confident. And like, and you have to own that. You have to really be fucking hyper confident. And like, I just wasn't for a long time, you know? And
no, neither was I.
And it's funny. I remember we were playing in Corpus Christi or something like that, or McAllen, and Doug from The Sleeping, I remember talking to him, and he was always such a good front man. And like, they were opening for us. And I remember just thinking like, God, he's so much more exciting to watch than me. You know what I mean? Like, I feel fucking weird going on after him, because he's so exciting. He just owns the crowd. And I just go up there and I play my songs. And I remember talking to him about it. And he was like, yeah, why don't you try like putting your foot up on the monitor or something? He was like, trying to give me like specific advice on like how to perform better. And I did it. And now to this day, like, I use in-ear monitors. You're going to fucking laugh. I'm really fucking opening the curtain here to anybody listening. But to this day, I use in-ears, you know, so I don't need monitors anymore. And I keep the wedges in front of me just to put my fucking foot up on them. It's like I feel fucking so weird if I can't now.
Well, there's always those guitar parts that are harder too. You got to get the guitar up to, you know.
Well, yeah, Jack does all those.
Yeah, I guess he does. Yeah, what a guy, what a guitar player.
Yeah, nice to be in a band with Jack. It makes my job easier.
That's funny. Yeah, you still have the wedges up there. Well, we have boxes we just put up there.
Right.
You know, so we have like, we don't have monitors because we use in-ears too. But we actually have our own boxes to stand on, the ego boosters, which is a really funny term, ego booster or ego riser, because that's what you're trying to do. Use that confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird thing. So, you know, that's where Vacancy came from, the writing of it and the meaning behind it and all that, the songs. Making the record was crazy. Like, making the record, we made it in Nashville because I have my daughter here.
Jack lives there too, right?
And Jack lives here too. And Jack, when we were making the record, Jack had just had his baby. His baby was like 2 months old, months old. Like,
wow.
Just had the baby. And we knew while we were planning the record that we had to, that was going to happen. He hadn't had the baby yet. And we were like, yeah, but by the time we go in the studio, like, he's going to have a newborn at home. We like, so between, you know, my situation with my daughter, and like I said, I don't have a lot of friends here. I don't have any family here. I don't really have any help with her. So my weeks with her, like, I worship those weeks, you know, like,
of course.
So I was, so we were saying, like, we have to make the record in Nashville because Jack and I can't leave. So the guys came down to Nashville. It was really fucking hard. It took us a while to find a producer. It took us a long time to find a producer. We met with a couple of different guys and got all the way through the point of going over songs, going wow. through notes, all that. And it kind of was, they were all kind of falling apart for one reason or another, whether it was money or they didn't want to come to Nashville. They didn't want to spend, because, you know, none of the guys that we were talking to were from here. So a lot okay. of guys that were like, yeah, I'm not going to go live in, like, I'm 55 years old. I'm not going to go, like, live in a hotel in Nashville for 5 weeks, you know?
Sure.
So, so we started talking to Tim O'Hare, who had done,
Say Anything
lots of
record
cool shit. Yeah. So much yeah. cool stuff. Sebado, Say Anything, All American Rejects.
Oh yeah. I mean, All American Rejects too, right?
Yeah. So he like so much cool shit, but from, he did like really cool indie shit. He did really cool punk shit. And then he did really cool, like, pop shit, you know, mm-hmm. it was like, cool. Like, this guy kind of, and you know, yeah, he gets it. And Bayside's music's kind of all over the place. So it was like, yeah, like somebody who kind of gets a lot of different styles would be great. And Tim just, he was actually just nominated for a Tony for, he did the sound nice. Design for Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Oh, wow.
Cool. So we're like, yeah, dude, he fucking knows shit. And Bayside, and like, we've been saying this for a while. It's like nobody really realizes it, but Bayside is show tunes. Bayside is like punk rock show tunes. You know,
yeah,
like all the
I totally know, man.
I know, dude. All like the weird,
the
like
weird
whimsical,
inverted chords and stuff. Yeah,
yeah. All the inverted chords, the time signature changes, the key changes, all the drama in our music. Like that is all straight out of show tunes. Like I write show tunes and then we speed them up. You know, like that. It's funny, and nobody really realizes that. And I was like, dude, a fucking guy who does punk rock records, who knows show tunes, like, so, like he's gonna get it. And he did, and he totally got it. And it was a cool process. His process was super stressful for us, though.
Oh, the way he works?
Just the way he works was very stressful, and we were all at each other's throats through the whole record, which is that's the recipe for the best records.
Sometimes, yeah,
and. Dude, like we went, we moved into the studio, and we got totally duped on this one studio. The fucking train was about 50. A freight train was about 15 feet from the front door, and it was coming by like every 15 minutes, blowing the fucking horn.
Who would build a studio there,
dude? That's not even the worst of it. It was attached to a factory. It shared a wall with a factory. The live room shared a wall with a factory. So. When you went into the live room, the machinery from the next room was so loud that the live room was unusable. You couldn't use the live room because
ridiculous.
Of the bleed from the fucking machines.
It's ridiculous.
And the vocal booth was getting bleed from the fucking trains. The train horn was coming through the vocal mic. It was fucked. It was so fucked.
So you're literally
like,
in the middle of a session and the train comes by and you have to stop and wait for the train.
Well, we didn't get that far because okay. we started doing the drums. We did the drums in about a 10 by 10 ISO booth because we couldn't use the live room. So the drums got recorded in like a fucking ISO booth.
Right.
And it was a fucking nightmare. There was one bathroom that was shared by for the studio and the fucking factory. So there's always somebody in the bathroom. You had to walk through the factory. You had to walk to the back of the factory to fucking...
Insane. This is insane.
To use the bathroom. So we were just like peeing outside. We were just going out and fucking peeing on the train tracks. So it was just... It was fucking... it was so crazy. And then... So we did the drums. You couldn't really hear anything because the control room was like enormous. It was the size of a live room and all wood and treated like a live room. It was like, dude, you can't all the sound is bouncing all over the place. You can't really hone in on anything when you're
sure.
hearing playback. Like we're recording the drums in this 10 by 10 room. You're worried that you're not going to get enough room sound. Right. So
of course,
we're listening
yeah.
back. So we're listening back and you hear all this room sound, but we're like, is that coming through the takes or is that the playback bouncing around the room we're listening to it in? Yeah,
bizarre.
Fuck. So we started doing guitars Because we always do guitars before bass. We always do drums, guitars, bass.
We always do guitars first too.
Yeah, it's good for tuning.
Yep.
So we were doing. So we start doing guitars, and then there's like latency on the guitars. We're like, all right, that like that's the
we're
like,
out of here.
That we can't get through that. You know what I mean? So
that's weird.
So this was at like 9 o'clock at night or something like that, and we called everybody we knew, and we were just like, we need to be in a new studio tomorrow. All the while, we have this deadline, hard deadline to finish the record because we're already booking the tour that's going to be around the release of the record. And we're only a week into recording it at this point. So we're like, we have to fucking finish this record on time. So we call everybody we know in Nashville. We're saying we need to be in a new studio tomorrow. Like, and we need it for like 4 weeks. Who can get us in tomorrow? So we get a call. A good friend of ours is he's like an auxiliary musician for Kings of Leon.
Okay.
And he like is their touring kind of guitar player and keys and that stuff. And he you might know, you know Ethan Luck?
I'm sorry?
Do you know Ethan Luck? You might know. He was in Reliant K.
No, I don't know. I don't think I know him, no.
Well, so Ethan calls and he says Kings of Leon has this like basically a compound. And okay. And there's a giant, it's basically like their own personal SIR. It's a huge sound stage that's like just for them. And they have a fucking badass studio in there that they record like their demos. They actually did their last record in their compound. Like it's all this stuff. I could go on and on about how crazy this place was. He says, they're in LA recording their record. It's empty for a while. Like they said, you guys could have it. And we kind of worked out like a figure, you know, a budget that worked. And so we recorded it at like Kings of Leon's like private kind of demo studio. That's where we finished the record.
That's so, and you don't know those guys at all.
No, and it was super weird. They had all this gear there and like we were so worried because there was cameras and shit and we were all like, fuck, don't touch anything we're not allowed to touch. Don't fucking like, if you sneeze, cover your fucking mouth. We're just like kind of like so scared.
Do they have old amps and stuff but you weren't allowed to use them?
They took a lot of the amps. They had a shitload of guitars and we weren't allowed to use them, but they had taken all the, they had shipped all the amps to LA for the recording.
So
we finished the record there and we were just kind of like up against it. Like by the end of the session, we called Arun from Saves the Day to come in. We called Steve from Punchline to come in and engineer like side sessions. Wow. We set up a second computer in another room. Because, I mean, it's just like their kind of project studio, you know? So there wasn't like a B room or anything. So we kind of created our own B room and had like Arun and Steve coming in to like record background vocals with me while Tim was in the main room like doing Jack's guitars.
Wow. Like, so you really, real time crunch.
Yeah. It was just the whole process was crazy. And there was still a train that would come by that studio too. So the whole process of making the record was nuts, man. And we left the studio without roughs and we have the label breathing down our back of what song do you want to be the B-side, what's the sequencing gonna be, we need to get the artwork together for the vinyl, all the shit. Like I haven't even heard the fucking record. I can't tell you what the sequencing is.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So who picked it? Was a crazy process. You didn't even pick the sequencing?
We picked the sequencing on the deadline.
After you heard all the mixes?
Today. Today was the deadline to get the vinyl in, to get like the master to the vinyl.
Right.
And the artwork to them and all that. And the record got mastered on Wednesday. And that was and we picked the sequencing on Tuesday night. We made a sequencing. Crazy. Wednesday got mastered. And then that's when the artwork was able to get finished on Wednesday because that's when we had the sequencing. And then today it went out to press.
Wow.
Yeah. Gnarly.
Well, I think it's almost a good problem. If you're not sure about the sequencing and you're kind of good with like whatever sort of works, in a way that can be good because that means all the songs are pretty good.
Yeah, it is good. We're actually having a really hard time. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe just because none of them are sort of standing out in the single sense, or maybe just because they're all great, but we're having a really hard time even picking what the single is going to be, picking what the first song release is going to be. We announced the record on Tuesday with pre-orders and all that. And everybody's like, you're selling the pre-orders and you haven't like released a song yet. We're like, it doesn't exist yet. This is the day before mastering. We announced the record the day before the record got mastered. We're like, it doesn't even exist yet. We couldn't have released a single if we wanted to right now.
That's funny.
Even if we knew which song it was going to be. And now I think we're going to release a song like in the next couple of weeks.
Good, good.
And we still don't even know what song it's going to be yet. It's a crazy process. But we're just like, this is all too fucking weird for this not to be good.
I think there's something to that. Weirdly enough, I think that's a real thing, man. No, that's rad. Can't wait to hear it. Vacancy, August 19th. When we go on tour 2 weeks before that, what are you doing in the meantime?
Man, not much, to be honest with you. I don't know. I kind of started writing a book like last year.
Oh yeah.
And I didn't get, it was just something I kind of did for fun, really. I just, just kind of started throwing a few things down. And I didn't know that I'd ever, get back to it or whatever. It was just kind of like...
Is it a novel?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a fictional novel. Yeah. And, and it's nothing right now. It's a few pages right now. But over the last few days, I have 4 months off. I mean, now that the record's done, I have 4 months until the tour starts. And I don't really have anything to do in those 4 months. So I was kind of thinking I need a project. I got to work on something. Maybe I could start writing the next solo record while I'm sitting around. Maybe I could, or maybe I'll get back to this book. I got to be productive somehow for the next 4 months. I can't fucking watch TV and you know what I mean? I got to do something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's cool. No,
so I'm thinking about maybe
now that you've told everybody about the book on this podcast, you got to do it. So now you're committed.
Yeah. Right.
People are going to come up to you at a show and be like, I heard on Shane's podcast that you're doing a book. When's it coming?
Right. Exactly.
And you'll be like, that's still not happening.
And that's going to be the news item that gets picked up everywhere. Nobody's going to pay attention to the next single. It's just going to be like, he's writing a book. He's writing a book. Just the worst, your worst press photo is the one that is going to be everywhere.
Of course, of course, of course. That's very funny, man. Well, hey, this is probably the longest one I've done. Why don't I let you go? But we'll do a part two. Maybe once the record's out.
Yeah, sure.
And maybe you want, man. We'll see where you're at with your life, man. But thanks for taking the time and pouring your heart out to this man. And I really hope. Everything goes awesome with the new record and everything you got going on in your life.
Yeah, same to you, man. I hope everything. Thank you. I hope you get it all figured out.
Yeah, that's what I'm working on. So thank you.
Yeah, well, it was great. It was great catching up. I miss you.
Yeah, but we didn't even talk about your solo stuff. I miss you too, man. We didn't talk about all the solo stuff you're doing or so much we didn't talk about. We didn't even talk about Victory, and that was what I want. And that's what I wanted to talk about because I had I had Tommy from Between the Buried and Me. I talked to him yesterday, actually.
Oh yeah.
And so he's going to be, I think you're probably going to roll this one out first or then him. I'm not sure which one. But yeah, we were talking about Victory and stuff. And I was like, man, this is like a little bit of a Victory, old Victory days story time. And I'm sure you got some Tony stories. So we'll save it for next time.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I would love to do it again. I'm glad we finally got to connect.
Absolutely, Anthony. Thank you, man.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Yeah, you have a great day.
You too. Bye.
All right. Yeah, see ya. Hey, you guys still there? It was a long one, but wow, we covered so much ground and we didn't even get to everything. So I'm sure once Vacancy comes out, we'll try to do it sooner than later. We'll have Anthony back. We'll tell some old Victory stories and we'll just check in and see how he's doing and, see how I'm doing as well. As always, I'm going to leave you with some tunes. If you like the show, please go on iTunes, write a review, preferably 5 stars. It really helps us out. It really helps us just get this podcast in front of more people, keep it growing. We'll get better and better guests. So I'm going to pick, as if this isn't long enough already, I'm actually going to play 2 songs. I'm going to play my personal favorite Bayside song, which is called Just Enough to Love You from their first album. It's a bit of a deep cut, but what a song. And then I'm going to leave you with actually a Silverstein song called Texas Mickey, which we brought Anthony in and he sang on and he did an amazing job on it. So I want you to hear both those songs. So I'll leave you with those 2 tunes. And hey, thanks a lot. We'll see you next Monday. All the best. Peace and love.
Push me out from the darkness into a sky that's colored blue. Somewhere someone finds a happiness while I'm still here, so hung up on you. Nothing is real, and I want you to I'll try not to flinch. Won't make promises. my own head. A failed apology, a dead to it, but now I see that all you really wants to see me dangled at first from a tree. What would you need me for? You got friends galore, and all you've ever been to me is a waste of time and nothing more. Nothing is real. The stupid drama that painted my world black.